And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, been behind closed doors for 42 days now. It is April 22nd, 2020. And we went behind closed doors on March the 10th. Now, it's, now this is the 112th day of the year. The, and it's quite an interesting day in history. The, in the year 238, the Roman Senate outlaws Emperor Maximus Trax for his bloodthirsty prescriptions in Rome and nominates two of its members, Pipinus and Balbinus, to the throne. It was known as the Year of Six Emperors. And certainly it was, Rome was quite an interesting empire. They certainly were bloodthirsty enough. In the year 1500, Portuguese navigator Pedro Alvarez Cabral lands in Brazil. 1519, Spanish conquistador Hernan Cortes establishes a settlement at Veracruz, Mexico. 1529, the Treaty of Zaragoza divides the Eastern Hemisphere between Spain and Portugal along a line 780 miles east of the Moluccas. In those days, Portugal was quite the power. In 1622, the capture of Ormuz by the East India Company ends Portuguese control of Hormuz Island. 1809, the second day of the Battle of Ekmal, the Austrian army is defeated by the First French Empire army led by Napoleon. They actually drove the Austrians across the Danube in Regensburg. 1836, day after the Battle of San Jacinto, forces under Texas General Sam Houston identified Mexican General Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna among the captives taken in that battle. Some of his own people mistakenly gave away his identity. 1864, U.S. Congress passed the Coinage Act of 1864. Mandates the inscription, "In God We Trust," be placed on all coins minted as U.S. currency. 1876. First game in the history of the National League is played at the Jefferson Street Grounds in Philadelphia. This was the beginning of Major League Baseball. 1889. At noon, thousands rushed to claim land in the land rush of 1889. Within the hours, the cities of Oklahoma City and Guthrie are formed with populations of at least 10,000. 1898, the USS Nashville captures a Spanish merchant ship. 1906, the Intercalculated Games, now recognized as part of the official Olympics, open in Athens. 1915, the use of poison gas in World War I escalates when chlorine gas is released as a chemical weapon in the Second Battle of Ypres. Or Ypres, I've heard it pronounced both ways. In 1930, the United Kingdom, Japan, and the U.S. signed the London Naval Treaty regulating submarine warfare and limiting shipbuilding. 1944, the first Air Commando Group using Sikorsky R-4 helicopters staged the first use of helicopters in combat with search and rescue operations in the China-Burma-India theater. 1944, Operation Persecution is initiated. Allied forces land in the Hollandia area of New Guinea, currently known as Jayapura. 1944, in Greenland, the Allied Sledge Patrol attacked the German Bassgeiger weather station. 1945, prisoners at the Jasenovac concentration camp revolt. 520 are killed and about 80 escape. 1948, In the Arab-Israeli War, the port city of Halifa is captured by Jewish forces. 1951, Korean War. The Chinese People's Volunteer Army began assaulting positions defended by the Royal Australian Regiment and the Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry at the Battle of Cap Yong. 1954, witnesses began testifying and live TV coverage of the Army McCarthy hearings began. 1969, a British yachtsman, Sir Robin Knox Johnson, or Johnston, wins the Sunday Times Golden Globe race and completes the first solo nonstop circumnavigation of the world. 1969, the formation of the Communist Party of India, which was Marxist-Leninist, is announced at a mass rally in Calcutta. 1970, the first Earth Day is celebrated. 1972, increased American bombing in Vietnam prompts anti-war protesters in Los Angeles, New York, and San Francisco. 1977, optical fibers first used to carry live telephone traffic. 1983, the German magazine Stern claims the Hitler diaries have been found in wreckage in East Germany. The diaries are subsequently revealed to be forgeries. 1992, in a series of explosions in Guadalajara, Mexico, 206 are killed, 500 injured, and 15,000 left homeless. 1993, 18-year-old Stephen Lawrence is murdered in a racially motivated attack while waiting for a bus in Wellhall, Eltham. 1997, Hoch Kamitsky massacre in Algeria where 93 villagers are killed. In 2000, in a pre-dawn raid, federal agents seized 6-year-old Elon Gonzalez from his relative's home in Miami. 2004, two fuel trains collide in Rancheon, North Korea, killing up to 150 people. 2005, Japan's Prime Minister, Ichiro Koizumi, apologizes for Japan's war record. 2008, U.S. Air Force retires the remaining F-117 Nighthawk aircraft in service. 2013, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police arrest and charge two men with plotting to disrupt the Toronto area train service in a plot claimed to be backed by Al-Qaeda elements. 2014, more than 60 people are killed and 80 are seriously injured in a train crash in the Democratic Republic of the Congo's Katanga province. 2016, the Paris Agreement is signed, which is said to be an agreement to help fight global warming. 2019, the Luzon earthquake kills at least 18 people in the Philippines. And, of course, there's numerous bursts on this date in history that had political import. 296, Pope Caius died. 536, Pope Agnopetus I died. It's just amazing how many were born and died on this particular day. Now, Christian feast days, Asepsimus of Anita and companions in the Catholic Church, Arwald, Epipodius and Alexander, Hudson Stuck, that's the Episcopal Church, and John Muir, that's an Episcopal Church feast day. Opportuna of Montreal, Pope Caius, Pope Soter, Saint Signorina. April 22nd, the Eastern Orthodox Liturgics. It's Discovery Day in Brazil, and it's the International Observation of Earth Day, and it's Holocaust Remembrance Day in Serbia. The, Earth Day is an annual event celebrated around the world on April 22nd to demonstrate support for environmental protection. First celebrated in 1970, now includes events coordinated globally by the Earth Day Network in more than 193 countries. In 1969, at a UNESCO conference in San Francisco, peace activist John McConnell proposed the day to honor the Earth, the concept of peace, to first be celebrated on March 21st, 1970. first day of spring in the northern hemisphere. This day of nature's equipoise was later sanctioned in the proclamation written by McConnell and signed by Secretary General U. Thant at the United Nations. A month later, U.S. Senator Gaylord Nelson proposed the idea to hold a nationwide environmental teach-in on April 22, 1970. Hired a young activist by the name of Dennis Hayes to be the national coordinator. Nelson and Hayes renamed the event Earth Day. Nelson later was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom in recognition of his work. The first Earth Day was focused on the U.S. In 1990, Dennis Hayes, the original national coordinator in 1970, took it international, organized events in 141 countries. On Earth Day in 2016, the Paris Agreement was signed by the U.S., China, and 120 other countries. The signing satisfied a key requirement for the entry into force of the historic draft climate protection treaty adopted by consensus of the 195 nations present at the 2015 United Nations Climate Change Conference in Paris. The problem with the Paris Agreement, it really didn't do anything other than, yeah, we all agree. And U.S., you fund it, which seems to be pretty much the way things are, no matter what the event is. We fund it. Well, the sad commentary is literally nothing has been accomplished. The you know, there's been growing eco-activism even before the Earth Day in 1970. In 1968, Morton Hilbert and the U.S. Public Health Service organized the Human Ecology Symposium, which was an environmental conference for students to hear from scientists about the effects of environmental degradation on human health. And this was actually the beginning of what became known as Earth Day. For the next 2 years, Hilbert and students worked to plan the first Earth Day in April 1970, along with a federal proclamation from U.S. Senator Gaylord Nelson. The first Earth Day was held. Now, Project Survival, an early environmentalism awareness education event, was held at Northwestern University on January 23, 1970. This was the first of several events held at university campuses across the country. This was a lead-in to the first Earth Day, and Ralph Nader started talking about ecology that same year. 1960s had been a very dramatic period for ecology in the U.S. Pre-1960 grassroots activism against DDT in Nassau County, New York, and widespread opposition to open-air nuclear weapons testing with global nuclear fallout, it inspired Rachel Carson to write her influential bestseller, Silent Spring, in 1962. Well, Gaylord Nelson, the senator, chose April 22nd in order to maximize participation on college campuses for what he conceived as an environmental teach-in. He decided the week of April 19th through the 25th was the best bet. It didn't fall during exam or spring break. And it didn't conflict with religious holidays such as Easter or Passover, and it was late enough in spring to have decent weather. More students were likely to be in class, and there'd be less competition with other midweek events. So he chose Wednesday, April 22nd. The day also fell after the anniversary of the birth of noted conservationist John Muir. National Park Service, the John Muir National Historical Site, has a celebration every year on or around Earth Day. It's called Birthday Earth Day in recognition of Earth Day and John Muir's contribution to the collective consciousness of environmentalism and conservationism. Unbeknownst to Nelson, April 22nd, 1970 was the 100th anniversary of the birth of Vladimir Lenin. When translated to the Gregorian calendar, which the Soviets adopted in 1918. Now, Time reported some suspected that date wasn't a coincidence, but a clue that the event was a communist trick. They quoted a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution as saying, subversive elements plan to make American children live in an environment that's good for them. J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI, may have found the Lenin connection intriguing. It was alleged the FBI conducted serious surveillance to the 1970 demonstrations. And the idea that the date was chosen to celebrate Lenin's centenary was still persists in some quarters. An idea born out of the similarity with the Subotnik instituted by Lenin in 1920 as days in which people would have to do community service, which typically consisted of moving rubbish from public property and collecting recyclable materials. Subotniks were also imposed in other countries within the compass of Soviet power, including Eastern Europe, and at the height of its power, the Soviet Union established a nationwide Subotnik to be celebrated on Lenin's birthday, April 22nd, which had been proclaimed a national holiday celebrating communism by Nikita Khrushchev in 1955. Well, the problem is many of these celebrations and many of these groups are totally opposed to capitalism, and it so from that point of view they're their own worst enemy when it comes to gaining support. Now, you know, we've been talking about a lot of interesting topics. And we've been talking about secrets of World War II, and today we're going to kind of shift gears, so to speak. We're going to talk about Dark Fleet, which has been known as a secret Nazi space program. Well, there's been a lot of talk in the UFO community that there are alien races who are working very hard to enslave the human race. You know, the Nag Hammadi Library is a collection of 13 ancient manuscripts discovered in a cave in southern Egypt in 1945. Was an astounding, extremely important find to reveal the thinking of the earliest disciples of Jesus, who were known as the Gnostics. And many of the Gnostic beliefs are in stark contrast to the writings of the early disciples connected to the Pauline Roman Christians as recorded in the New Testament. Now, what most people, most Protestants, are not aware of, Paul, who was one of the disciples, basically was the marketing guru who really took Christianity forward, his version of Christianity. Now, the English translation of the codices was completed in 1970 and offers actual dialogues of the disciples as in a manner that you might associate with a screenplay. And this discovery caused a major reevaluation of early Christian history and presented a comprehensive explanation of the Gnostics and Gnosticism. And the Gnostic codices are the earliest source of information about the Archons. Now, John Lash is a mythologist, an author, and a teacher. And he's one of the most knowledgeable authorities on Gnosticism and the Archons. He's got a website called Metahistory. Excuse me, on his website, Metahistory, he says Archons are a species of inorganic beings that emerged in our solar system prior to the formation of the Earth. They are cyborgs inhabiting the planetary system. They're an alien race that intrudes subliminally upon the human mind and deviates our intelligence away from its proper and sane applications. Gnostics saw the signature of an alien species that piggybacks on the worst human failings. For this reason, archons are known as psycho-spiritual parasites. Now, he wrote an internet article called The Gnostic Theory of Alien Intrusion. And in it, he says the non-combative material contains reports of visionary experiences of the initiates, including first-hand encounters with inorganic beings called archons, A-R-C-H-O-N-S. Gnostic teaching explains that these entities arose in the early stage of formation of the solar system before the Earth was formed. These archons inhabit the solar system, the extraterrestrial realm as such, and they can intrude on the Earth. And he went on to say, though archons do exist physically, the real danger they pose to humanity is not invasion of the planet, but invasion of the mind. They're intrapsychic mind parasites who assess human consciousness through telepathy and simulation. They infect our imagination and use the power of make-believe for deception and confusion. They take pleasure in deceit for its own sake without a particular aim or purpose. They're robotic in nature, incapable of independent thought or choice, and have no particular agenda except to live vicariously through human beings. And they are bizarrely able to pretend an effect on humans, which they don't really have. For example, they can't access human genetics, but they can pretend to do so in such a way that humans fall for the pretended act, as if stage events are taken for real. In this respect, they're considered the ultimate in hoaxers. It's the essence of archonic intrusion. The trick is, if humanity falls under the illusion of superhuman power, it becomes as good as real, a self-fulfilling delusion, so to speak. Well, from this, it's easy to see why alien interlopers would have chosen these beings to do a dirty work for them. They've employed the archons to keep us tied down to our lowest mental spiritual level while they sit back and enjoy the show. Now, the actual aliens are mentally powerful, and consequently find it easy to control the archons, having long off-world experience with them. Now, a lot of these aliens are referred to by those in the UFO community as reptilians. And in order for them to enslave the human race, it was first necessary to seal us off from our friends elsewhere in the galaxy. Since they knew these friends could offer assistance, it was likely to be at least as technologically advanced as the science of the reptilians. Maybe the most potent technique for preventing this was the construction by the reptilians of an electrostatic force field around the planet in the very early days of the existence of the human race. And this was accomplished by aiming scalar sonic pulses at the Earth's inner grid system for about 30,000 years ago. Installed by the ancient deities known as the Anunnaki and referred to it in the Nibiru electrostatic transduction field, it's got the effect of preventing outgoing and incoming signals to and from the higher dimensions. Now, according to what's called the Ascension Glossary, an online compendium of all the subjects of study encompassed in the raw material in the Law of One teachings as originally presented by Don Elkins and Carla Lukert, it blankets the civilization, isolating it from its natural connections to its inner consciousness and spiritual levels. It's believed the reptilians knew even then that the creation of the human race on Earth was a serious threat to their ownership of this planet because of our connection to the higher spiritual powers of the cosmos. The Nibiru electrostatic transduction field applied to all races and nations on the planet. But because the Germanic races had genetic qualities that made them ideal candidates to carry out the reptilians' plans, they were less spiritually evolved than the other humans, and they were then physically and psychically enhanced by the archons and their genetic qualities. I mean, after all, they were the direct descendants of the Vikings and the barbarians who brought down the mighty Roman Empire. So they became the chosen people to carry out their archonic agenda and were changed so that as to become actually what could be called proto-human. Now, the first stage of this invasion was the modification of the planetary logos. According to the Ascension Glossary, The planetary logo says the original blueprint and law governing Earth's planetary body. The Earth's magnetosphere exists on the seventh dimensional level, which is the plane of the violet ray from which it interacts with our sun. Now, there's a lot of material that has been making the rounds. Some of it doesn't make a great deal of sense to a lot of people, but unfortunately, there are those who view it as the gospel, so to speak. Now, the primary means of human enslavement by the Archons is mind control. And according to the Ascension Glossary, one has control over the mind, one has control over the directions and actions of the physical body and all of its parts and over the ongoing mental effort to reclaim the soul energies. Consequently, if you control the mind, you also control the soul. Now, mind control is used to form socially acceptable belief systems, at the same time create anti-human value systems that are used to convince the masses to literally enslave themselves. This creates what might be referred to as an oxymoronic death culture, which generates thoughts that are in contradiction with each other, like going to war and killing in the name of peace. As long as the planet's at war with itself and humanity thinks we're at war with each other, we're supporting the mind control system of the Archons and Reptilians. And there's been more death and destruction in the name of God than in almost any other cause you can imagine. Now, in the early 20th century, when the aliens were said to be ready for the final stage of their program to enslave the human race, their first priority was to select a country or a racial group to work through, a group that could be relied on to carry out their very complex agenda of hybridization, artificial intelligence, poisoning of the air, food and water, mind control, wars, and other disasters. And they had to wait until the developments in science, technology, and industrialization had reached the point where their proto-human puppets, many refer to them as the Illuminati, were able to handle the complexities of the job. So these plans had been honed to perfection over thousands of years, during which time they'd enslaved millions, maybe billions of the inhabitants of planets and 21 star systems in their galaxy. Choosing the Germans to attain these reptilian goals was logical and tactical. More than any other racial group, the Germans were amazingly disciplined and able to achieve remarkable accomplishments by rapidly organizing huge industrial structures along hierarchical lines and ensuring that the reporting discipline from one level to another was efficient and highly regimented. And I would point out that from being totally destroyed at the end of World War I, they became remarkably advanced by 1945, which has to raise many interesting questions as to where that knowledge came from. How to go from open cockpit planes to jets in, what, less than 30 years? It was unheard of. Well, this discipline was the key to achieving results in large corporate, military, and governmental agencies. In this type of system, each departmental level has little or no knowledge of activity at other levels, and through this method, large numbers of employees can be made to produce products or carry out activities that are basically antisocial, inhuman, or in some cases, even evil. It's this separation, keeping all groups on a strictly need-to-know basis by the management, that allows all this to happen. Well, the aliens knew this to be necessary because they didn't want to risk a rebellion in the ranks triggered by idealistic employees if their real objectives were uncovered. They intended to implement their takeover plans through large corporate entities, and secrecy was imperative. A capitalistic corporate industrial structure was vital to their plans. They knew that democratic and socialistic political systems were antithetical to their program, which is why they made sure to operate through anti-democratic and anti-socialistic authoritarian regimes. The main problem with this structure is a lack of creativity that results. When workers are forced to just follow orders, good ideas are repressed, and the consequences are a product or a system that may be finished on time but lacks all the enhancements that would have been possible by incorporating the ideas and suggestions of subordinates all along the way. So this, in fact, dilutes the entire effort. But that's the price the elite are willing to pay to obtain the basic results. And that's why it was possible for a Kaiser and a Fuhrer to realize the accomplishment of their whims so quickly. And so the alien planners could depend on them to achieve their goal, be it social, industrial, or military. And also the German workers or soldiers didn't allow humane or ethical values to interfere with the process. To them, efficiency was everything. Human lives were just numbers. They got the job done without regard for the human toll, with no regrets. Well, in such an environment, the leaders at the top who make the policies are all important, while the middle and lower level workers take care of the simple, basically mindless and repetitive task. Now, these individuals are genetically disposable and easily replaceable if they show any hesitation or sign of remorse. But eventually, the managers at the top don't want to bother with all the effort and attention it takes to fool the workers into thinking they're doing something socially valuable. So ultimately, they just resort to what you might refer to as a form of slavery, in which keeping track of salaries and recreation for their workers is no longer necessary. Doing away with all pretenses, they implement Gestapo-like tactics to control the organization and get their work done with outright slavery. I mean, the Herculean job necessary to effect the emergence of a unified Germany as an armed, scientific, and industrial European power at the commencement of the 20th century was basically due to the efforts and policies of one man, Prussian Prime Minister and later German Chancellor Otto von Bismarck. During the short period of his reign between 1862 and 1914, Germany was transformed from a collection of disputatious independent states into a comprehensive, politically unified, highly industrialized country under the dominance of Prussia. It began with the elevation of William I as King of Prussia in 1861 after the death of his brother, King Frederick William IV. William was dedicated to the unification of the German states. Believing the best way to unify Germany was through war, he depended primarily on his war minister, Count von Roon. However, they weren't able to build an effective military because of the liberal opposition in Parliament. But then in September of 1862, William appointed Bismarck to the office of Prime Minister. And Bismarck, beyond any shadow of a doubt, was a force to be reckoned with. He essentially disregarded Parliament and imposed new taxes dictatorially to pay for a new military. Now, what he did was illegal, but as is often the case, strong, bold moves by one determined leader catch the vacillating opposition by surprise, and they can't marshal enough unified forces to defeat his or her policies. In a speech to the Parliament in 1862 to justify his actions, Bismarck uttered the famous phrase that is now echoed down through the years and that will come to characterize all such actions by future German dictators. He said, "The great questions of our time will not be decided by speeches and resolutions of minorities, but by blood and iron." This derogatory reference to resolutions of majorities, was essentially a rejection of democracy and an endorsement of autocracy. And blood and iron can only mean one thing, warfare, which uses tons of iron and spills oceans of blood. This was a prophetic utterance by Bismarck because it was from that moment on that the new nation of Germany became a succession of dictatorships and began a worldwide reign of blood and iron for a period that lasted 83 years. Now, this is overwhelming evidence Bismarck was really affiliated with the Illuminati, an alien-controlled human hybrid, if you will, who was sent to implement the alien agenda for the 20th century. But as with all things alien, it was based on a lie because it really didn't answer the great question of our time at all, but rather provoked a new and horrifying direction for humanity that is still being played out. Now, Bismarck was the first of a new generation of dictators, and he became the prototype of the autocratic German leaders that followed. He had multifaceted talents that allowed him to handle complicated political agendas with ease. He played other European political leaders against each other as though they were pawns on a chessboard and could achieve results that seemed impossible to others. He won three wars in quick succession, even though he himself wasn't really a military leader. Each time he enlarged Prussian territory and influence until Prussia became the new Germany. This allowed his autocratic successors, Kaiser Wilhelm II and Adolf Hitler, to inherit an enlarged and powerful nation. But most importantly, Bismarck's high intelligence permitted him to be at ease with the amazing industrial and technological advances that evolved during his reign. A time of changes that became known worldwide as the Second Industrial Revolution. Now, since Bismarck himself was an autocratic conservative leader, he imbued the corporations he fostered to be led the same way, especially Krupp AG and IG Farben. So the leaders of these corporations inherited the same greed, ambition, and indifference to human suffering that he displayed. He even set the stage for governmental anti-Semitism, which intensified later, even though the Jewish population in Prussia, Germany at the time was only 1%. An online announcement of a talk about his book, Bismarck, A Life, by Jonathan Steinberg, held May 26, 2011, by the Peirce Institute for the Study of Anti-Semitism, which is based in Birkbeck, University of London, said Jonathan Steinberg will argue that Bismarck staged the first act of the tragedy of German Jewry. Steinberg argues not only did anti-Semitism have deep roots in the autocratic aristocratic class from which Bismarck came, but also that Bismarck used it for when it suited his purposes. The first modern depression hit Germany in 1873, and Jews were prominent bankers, and they took the blame. Bismarck abandoned his liberal allies and after 1878 set out to destroy him by crushing the Jews and their leadership. He allowed a wave of anti-Semitism to spread and watched as the Prussian Parliament had its infamous Jew debate in 1880. First time the unified Germany declared that Jews weren't real Germans. See, the theory behind what Bismarck did was if there is an enemy I can point to, I can marshal all the support I need to go after that identified enemy. And the enemy he identified were the financial leaders who, for the most part, happened to be Jewish. Bismarck's plan to develop Germany into a world power was ambitious and multifaceted and certainly very difficult, if not impossible. It was highly pragmatic without any element of idealism. He played heavily on Prussia's strong suits, used what he had to good advantage, and overcame the disadvantages by using war and the threat of war to get what he wanted. Now, in terms of industrialization, before 1850, Germany was way behind Britain, France, and Belgium. But according to Wikipedia, it had a highly skilled labor force, a good educational system, a strong work ethic, good standards of living, and a sound protectionist strategy. Bismarck parlayed these strengths into a very effective strategy so that by 1900, Germany was a world leader in industrialization, on an even par with England and the United States. And this, according to Wikipedia, despite the fact that until mid-century, the guilds, the landed aristocracy, the churches, the government bureaucracies had so many rules and restrictions, entrepreneurship was held in low esteem and given little opportunity to develop. It really was a remarkable achievement and testifies to Bismarck's bold and unique mental powers, a characteristic we now know to be identified with alien intervention. It helped that Bismarck wasn't really attached to any particular ideology. It gave him perfect flexibility, and he was a virtual dictator. So he was able to use what became known as Realpolitik, that is, when it came to world power, any means to an end, and the end justifies the means. It can also be called power politics because power on the international stage is the only consideration. It can sometimes be described as peace through strength. Now, Realpolitik is an old and popular technique that's been practiced by venerated world leaders since ancient times. Probably the most famous was Niccolo Machiavelli, the Italian political philosopher who wrote The Prince, Frederick the Great of Prussia, Karl von Clausewitz, author of Own War, and, of course, Napoleon. Adolf Hitler may not have been aware of his philosophical debt to these men, but he proved to be an adept practitioner of real politics, grabbing Czechoslovakia and Austria without firing a shot. And that's not to say these men were necessarily unprincipled, but rather they understood well and endorsed the real underpinnings of world power. Now, through his political machinations, Bismarck created a climate in which industry could thrive, and subsequently huge German conglomerates evolved and rapidly caught up with those in the West. And Bismarck helped them along by instituting welfare programs for German industrial workers as early as the 1880s. He introduced old age programs, on accident insurance, medical care insurance, and unemployment insurance, making Germany a virtual welfare state. Keeping the workers happy, though, kept the owners happy and allowed Germany to rocket to the top of the world industrial hierarchy. In particular, the German chemical, coal mining, steel, railroad, and agricultural combines became world-class, primarily through the formation of cartels. The iron and steel companies bought the coal mines that formed integrated production facilities because steel manufacturing requires large admixtures of coke. These mixed firms, called concerns, multiplied rapidly, so that coal output went from 2 million tons in 1850 to 130 million tons in 1940. This set the stage for the massive Krupp works and the fearsome German Nazi weaponry of World War II. The railroads are also critical to German unification. Through the 1830s, each of the 37 states had its own railroad system, but by the 1840s, trunk lines connected the individual networks. And then by the time of the creation of the German Empire in 1871, the national railroad system was in place and growing and approaching equality with the British system. This spurred the growth and nationalization, especially the urbanization of the steel industry, which then developed rapidly and spread to university centers of research and development. As a result of this linkage between research and the manufacturing laboratories, Germany developed a rich and sophisticated chemical industry and quickly became a leader in chemicals. The founding of the Bayer Corporation and BASF laboratories in the 1880s catapulted Germany to dominance in world chemicals, so that by the outbreak of World War I in 1914, Germany had achieved 90% of the entire share of international volumes of trade in chemical products. So, as we see, this early monopolization of the chemical industry had important ramifications for World War II, when in 1925, these two huge corporations joined four others to form the gigantic IG Farben cartel. I think it's easy to say without IG Farben, you might not have had World War II, or at least you wouldn't have had it when it happened. But it was in banking that the German cartels had the most pronounced effects. By pooling money for investment and avoiding all the destructive effects of competition, the German banks and investment houses were able to pinpoint the financing of important industries. And this focus was, in turn, subject to the pressures of governmental politics. Certainly, the banks responded to the dictates of Bismarck for financing his wars. Jointly, they directed large pools of funds to industries that Bismarck deemed important to his political agenda. Well, side by side with the swift emergence of Germany as an empire in 1871 and as a world industrial power in 1900 was the transformation of the German population. They morphed from a peace-loving, relatively liberal agrarian society to a cosmopolitan, cynical, and sophisticated, citified people with a decided imperialistic and prideful orientation. And it happened in less than 30 years. Well, the ability of the archons to program the consciousness of targeted large groups of individuals make it possible for them to divide and conquer the human race by setting the citizens of one nation against those of another. And certainly this took place in World War One. Now, violent tendencies can also be promoted within male abductees undergoing the alien love bite, so to speak. Barbara Bartholik and Eve Lorgan have made in-depth studies of this form of alien manipulation. A French journalist interviewed Bartholik said that Barbara's the greatest alien abduction researcher in the world, bar none. The theory is that the abductions of humans actually is the beginning of a mental manipulation and a mental modification. There's, out of the many categories of abductees who are trained consciously or not for various jobs required to maintain the alien occupation, there's one type that's highly valued over all the others. Somebody who can be trained to become a reliable and useful asset to carry out specific types of assignments under the control of so-called deep black military professionals who are themselves experienced alien hybrids, or hybrids as they're called. This technique of training slaves to become managers of other slaves is a time-honored alien system to conserve their own resources and energies for only the most critical operations. While those in the rank and file of the slave population are rewarded some type of minor rewards or advantages if they can be used to train and supervise other low-level slaves. This system is revealed at its most effective in the Nazi concentration camps, where the camp administrators selected prisoners called capos, K-A-P-O-S, to manage the other prisoners. The employment of this system as early as 1940, long before the aliens made slaves out of the concentration camp inmates, tells us the aliens must view the entire human race essentially as a slave population. According to Wikipedia, a capo, or prisoner functionary, was a prisoner in a Nazi concentration camp who was assigned by the SS guards to supervise forced labor and carry out administrative tasks. Also called prisoner self-administration, the prisoner functionary system minimized costs by allowing camps to function with fewer SS personnel. The system was designed actually to turn victim against victim, as the prisoner functionaries were pitted against their fellow prisoners in order to maintain the favor of their SS overseers. If they were derelict, they'd be returned to the status of ordinary prisoner and be subject to other capos. Many prisoner functionaries were recruited from the ranks of violent criminal gangs rather than from more numerous political, religious, and racial prisoners. Such criminal convicts were known for their brutality toward other prisoners. And the SS tolerated this brutality, and it was an integral part of the camp system. Now, the use of this system, it's been maintained by the Nazis, is clear evidence that the entire Nazi population, but especially the SS, was a front for the alien interlopers, who we now believe, or many believe, were in league with Hitler. It can't be a coincidence the Nazis adopted this system of slave control in the concentration camps if they hadn't learned it from their alien overlords. Well, if you look at history, the almost every major empire has made use of slave labor. The Romans, the Egyptians. So there's really nothing new in the world. Now, in all likelihood, MILABs, or basically military abductees, or have some kind of genetic mark identifies them as legitimate alien abductees. Now, I've talked to many abductees since I started doing this show back in the 1980s, and many of them have a lot in common. And they have a lot of the same views. You know, alien abductees who have served in the armed forces have described mind control, medical experiments, and other coercive measures perpetrated on them during their stints in the military. Now, I spent a good many years in and associated with the military, and I didn't see that, but I've heard other stories that support this position. They've also described being utilized in covert operations while in a mind-control state. Some of them have shown advanced technology and have witnessed non-human life forms in underground and above-ground installations. I talked to a good many people who spent time in Area 51 who talked about associating with aliens. The training of what's known as MILABs is intensive and comprehensive. They're trained for a wide variety of jobs, most of which appear to be for conventional warfare roles on the physical plane. In other words, these men and women are primarily conditioned to become super soldiers in the Army, Navy, and Air Force in actual combat roles. So this tells us that the MILABS, as they're known, is being created for jobs that require military demeanor and advanced military skills, unlike others who are simply being conditioned in the astral dreamscape to accustom civilians to alien control, maybe used for a wide variety of roles when the aliens actually reveal themselves. These people likely will become the capos at that time, and the MILABS, the military abductees, will become the soldiers. Both techniques were used on the German and Japanese populations in World War II. Now, MILABS are sometimes brought to a military facility, the locations that are often described as being underground and are subject to hostile interrogations and, in some cases, outright torture. Now, these interrogations are really not interrogations at all. Usually the MILAB, very often a female MILAB, is asked the same question over and over. It's a question a MILAB can't answer because she doesn't know the answer. May be objected with a drug, or she may have a drug induced into her system by intravenous drip. The real purpose behind the interrogation is simply to provide her captors with an excuse to torture her. She may be made to sit in a chair with her arms tied to the back of the chair and her ankles tied to the legs. The interrogators may use handheld devices to give her a powerful electrical shock. They may even shock her close to her heart. Well, the military feel that the female MILAB's PSI abilities will be at their peak only after she's endured torture of this type. Now, I'm not really supportive of that reasoning, but from the short-term standpoint, the female abductee, thus abused, may indeed have higher than normal PSI abilities, but in the long term, be more likely to be uncooperative. In discussing abduction experiences with various people, many of whom were, in fact, female over the years, what came to light was the fact that there didn't seem to be a rhyme or reason for what was taking place other than what may be viewed as a type of indoctrination. Now, I talked to a number of people who professed various, well, to give you an example, there was one young lady who said that her father was the ambassador from the inner earth to the United Nations, and that she traveled the country by use of a high-speed underground transport system. Now, I'd heard rumors about a high-speed underground transport system for years, but I never had any evidence until I was interviewed her. She was in my studio, and 2 hours later, after the show ended, she called me from a New York telephone number. Now, I've discovered that that number was at a payphone at the main rail center in New York City. And I asked her to give me some kind of confirmation in actuality she had crossed the country in less than 2 hours. So her way of doing was to call me from Union Station. And when I tracked that phone number down, it was, in fact, at Union Station. So, how did she leave Anaheim, California, and call me from Union Station 2 hours later? Granted, she could have taken a jet across the country. But to cross the country is a several-hour flight with a number of layovers. So unless she had a private plane at her disposal, that was out. And even if she was able to get from airport to airport, getting to Union Station would have been time-consuming in and of itself. So the only rational explanation anybody, because I had several people assisting me looking into it, the only rational explanation we could come up with was, in fact, there was some other means of transportation that we weren't familiar with that allowed her to cross this country in under 2 hours. Now, there's been a lot of independent confirmation of the fact that there is a high-speed underground shuttle system. I've had a number of people who, as best as I could determine, didn't know each other, talk to me about a high-speed system. When I was in, I went to Dulcie chasing Sasquatch a number of years ago. And Dulcie Base, which was underneath Archuleta Mesa, which is right behind the little community of Dulcie. Dulcie is on the Jicarilla Apache Reservation. And it's a very small community. And they got a casino there. And I've been in bigger Village Inn restaurants than that casino. But a lot of people confirm the fact that a lot of strange activity went on in and around Archuleta Mesa. Now, on the other side of Archuleta Mesa is Skinwalker Ranch, where there's supposed to have been a lot of strange activities. If you've ever read any of the Skinwalker series, I had one of the war chiefs, traditional war chief. I was his guest while I was chasing Sasquatch. Asked me if I wanted to see the secret underground alien base. And I said, that's a myth. That's a legend. He said, let me show you the legend. Took me up on top of Archuleta Mesa. There is a military facility up there. And we saw a lot of black helicopters coming and going. By black helicopters, they have no insignia, no numbers, and they are painted matte black. And then when I started interviewing people, I got a lot of bizarre stories. In fact, if I can ever put everything together, I've got a video, a couple of videos about some of the bizarreness in and around Dulcie, New Mexico. Well, we've come to the end of another show. I'll be back tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Mountain. When once again, this will be Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.